The conference is being recorded.
Great, we're going to get going. Welcome, everybody. I'm glad to have so many smiling faces here on the telephone and on the Internet. My name is Phil Jordan. I'm from the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And I've been with the coalition for a little over 2 years, and I've got a background both in domestic violence advocacy and in disability rights.
March 31st. Hi, everybody. I'm Summer Carrick, and I work for the State Coalition, and I have a lot of experience working in shelter programs.
It was
I'm sorry, Summer. I think I just cut you off trying to mute other folks. Could you hit star 7 and start your introduction over?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Hi, everybody. This is Summer with the Coalition, and I've worked, I spent a lot of years working in shelters and have a lot of personal experience with service animals and shelters and all of those tensions, so I'm very happy to be here with you this morning.
Okay. Just a couple of housekeeping things. There's several ways you can ask questions. There's a raise your hand function, I believe, somewhere on the screen you're looking at on the Internet. And that will show up on the screen that Summer and I are looking at. And you can also type questions into the chat. We've got a lot of folks on the line today, so we may not be able to answer all the questions. Hopefully, as we go through, all your questions will get answered. And we will save a little bit of time at the end to make sure that we have some discussion and that everyone gets a chance to get their questions answered. If we do call on you during the webinar, we'll ask you to unmute so that we can actually hear you, which would be important. To unmute during the call, you will hit the button star 7, and then when you're done, you'll hit star 6, and you can remute your phone. This is being recorded, so keep that in mind, and you should have heard the warning, the disclaimer about that this webinar is being recorded. But I wanted to just reiterate that and make sure you all are aware of that. I think that's it. Oh, one more thing. I believe we're going to have Zach Burr on the phone with us today. Zach, are you on the call? If so, could you hit star 7 and say hi?
Hi, yes, this is Zach from Disability Rights Washington.
Great, I can barely hear you. Can you turn up your volume at all, Zach?
Yes, how's that?
That's better.
Okay, work with that.
Great. Zach is an attorney with Disability Rights Washington and was part of the legal review of this model protocol, and we're really glad he can be on the call with us today. And so thanks for joining us, Zach.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. So let's get going. Over the past about a year, Summer and I have been working on this draft protocol about service animals and domestic violence shelters. We had several focus groups and workshops on the issue. We had the Shelter Manager Learning Network involved in creating this. We had the Human Rights Commission weighed in on it, and Zach from Disability Rights Washington helped us do a legal review. And then we had a number of advocates who reviewed the draft and really helped us really sharpen this up so that it's a very useful document. And I just want to thank those folks who gave us their time and energy and really busy people who really took their time out to help us get this model protocol into the shape that it's in now. So I want to thank them. This webinar is going to be in three different sections. This first section is basic information about service animals and the people who use them. The second section is going to be talking about the laws that cover domestic violence shelters and service animals. After we get that basic information under our belts, then we'll be moving into sort of the more interesting part of the webinar, talking about advocacy practice and ways you can actually work with folks who have service animals in your shelter. So let's start off with what is a service animal. Service animals can be any kind of an animal that are individually trained to provide assistance or perform tasks for the benefit of a person with a disability. Any kind of an animal can be a service animal. I know that there is at least one domestic violence program in the state who has hosted a service snake, and that is always always interesting in our the workshops where we've done this. People are always worried about the service snakes. But it, just to know that most service animals are dogs, but they can be any kind of an animal. A lot of folks want to know what kind of certification the service animals have, what kind of documents show that they are actually a service animal. Service animals actually don't require any kind of documentation or certification. Some service animals do come with harnesses or collars or other things that identify them as working animals, but a whole bunch don't. So there is no required documentation for a service animal. You may have noticed that service animals, in the previous slide, service animals do need to be trained, but it's important to note that they don't need to be trained by a professional trainer. They can be trained by the person who owns them or by anybody. They don't have to be trained professionally. You may have heard a lot of reference to the terms companion animal or emotional support animal. These terms all describe a type of service animal. And it's a relatively new thing that's been going on over the past decade or so. People with emotional or psychological disorders are finding that emotional support animals can actually help alleviate their symptoms. And so they use these animals to help them manage their mental illness or their psychiatric disability. Sometimes you might hear the term prescription animal. And this is used when a medical professional actually documents, even though the documentation is not required, but a medical professional might document that the person needs an animal. So this is very often an emotional support animal that a medical professional is writing a prescription, essentially, that documents that the person has a disability and needs a service animal. Come on, slide. There we go. So a lot of folks want to know, so if there's no certification, how do I really know that animal is a service animal? The very short answer is that if a person says their animal is a service animal, take them at their word. Since they don't need documentation, this is the best way to approach that. If they say they have a service animal, believe them. And you need to make sure that you draw a clear distinction in your own mind between what is a pet and what is a service animal. Service animals are not pets. So if you have a no pet policy or if you have a no animal policy at your shelter or at your program or anywhere else, those policies do not pertain to service animals. All sorts of people with disabilities use service animals. It can be from a wide variety of disabilities performing a wide variety of tasks. Sometimes the animals provide support to the person. Sometimes they perform specific tasks. They often provide warnings. They can alleviate symptoms, as we've talked about with emotional support animals. They can help remove day-to-day barriers that people with disabilities experience, and they can actually help keep people healthy. So if a person is using a service animal, then they have a disability. And the laws, which we're going to talk about here in a few minutes, really limit what you can ask about a person's disability. And this is for a really good reason. Folks with disabilities have experienced a lot of discrimination over the years, which is why the disability rights laws were passed. There's a lot of stigma associated with disability, certainly with mental illness or with different kinds of substance abuse issues. There's a lot of stigma with all kinds of different disabilities. So the disability rights laws limit what you can ask a person about their disability, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more in depth when we get to that section. And it's really interesting to me that as I have been working here at the Coalition for the last 2.5 years or so, the value of believing survivors and of believing people really translates really well from my previous work in disability rights. It's so important to believe people who have been not believed and who have been discriminated against and who have faced violence. Since that's part of our work, it really makes me happy to know that that the disability rights perspective of valuing and believing people can come right over here to the domestic violence movement as well. A lot of folks will ask, don't I need to know about the survivor's disability so that I can know what kind of services to provide and know how I can actually write an advocacy plan or build a safety plan? Unfortunately, knowing the name of a survivor's disability or what their label is, what their diagnosis is, oftentimes can really lead you down a wrong path. Different disabilities and different disorders and diagnoses affect people in different ways. So you can really be misled by hearing what a person's disability is, and because you're probably going to make assumptions, as we all do, about what that person can and can't do, which is a real trap you don't want to fall into. For example, if someone were to say to me that they had a developmental disability, it would be really easy for me to jump to the conclusion that they have some kind of cognitive issue, that they have an intellectual disability, that they have a hard time understanding concepts, they have a hard time remembering things, that they have a hard time understanding complex issues. So I would be really tempted to make that leap in my head and make that assumption. Well, there's a lot of folks who have developmental disabilities who don't have that kind of cognitive disability. People with cerebral palsy are classified as having a developmental disability, and yet cerebral palsy doesn't affect cognitive function. So the same is true with all kinds of different psychiatric disabilities, psychiatric diagnoses. Knowing a label really doesn't help you get where you need to go. Now, what is helpful is knowing what a survivor might need support with or what will work for her. So instead of trying to find out what a person's label or diagnosis is, you might want to describe how things work at your program. At our shelter, we've got stairways up to the bedrooms. Will that work for you? We've got a lot of paperwork here. What works best for you with paperwork? Should we read it together and fill it out, or would you rather take it by yourself? Or do you need maybe you need an alternate format, a large print? But describing the process of what you'll actually be doing with the individual and then checking in to see if that will work for them is a better way of finding out what she needs support with rather than finding out what her label or diagnosis is and then making assumptions from there. So what do service animals do? There's all kinds of different service animals performing all kinds of different tasks and things for folks with disabilities. Hearing animals will alert a person who is deaf when a sound occurs. For instance, a doorbell, a fire alarm, things like that. Seeing eye or guide animals. You're probably all familiar with guide dogs who can help lead people who are blind get around. SSIG, or social signal animals, assist a person with autism. This is really interesting. I didn't know a lot about this until I started working on this project. But they help folks with autism process sensory input and can alert them to things that they may be doing that might be barriers to communication. For instance, folks with autism may have a behavior, like they'll slap their hand repeatedly when they feel stressed in a social situation. And the animal is trained to notify them that they're engaging in that behavior and to get them to stop so that that doesn't distract their communication anymore and the communication then is improved. Emotional support animals, we've talked a little bit about to help folks manage their symptoms of a psychiatric disability. Diabetes animals can carry medication for folks. They can go for help. And some animals have been trained to warn, to sense and warn of low blood sugar. And the same is true of seizure animals. A lot of seizure animals are able to sense when a person has a seizure coming on and can warn them of it. Oftentimes, seizure animals will stand over a person and protect them until help comes or until the seizure is over. There's lots of places to get more information about service animals if you're interested. I really recommend the Delta Society. They've got some really interesting stuff on service animals and what animals are able to do for folks. And their website is there up on the screen there. The Invisible Disabilities Advocate, this is a really interesting website. It's interesting to me how there's folks with very visible disabilities, people who, like folks with Down syndrome, you can tell they have a disability when you see them. But there's an awful lot of folks who have invisible disabilities, who either have stamina issues because of a medical issue, or have a psychiatric disability, all sorts of disabilities that are not visible to the naked eye when you first see a person. And there's some really interesting articles on this website that talks about that. Sites about assistance dogs, the Guide Horse Foundation. This is a really cool website if you're interested. These are miniature horses. They're about the size of a German Shepherd. And they are like guide dogs. They help people who are blind. They lead them around. And there are some real advantages to having a guide horse, a miniature horse. They live longer. They live up to 50 years long, so a person who is blind doesn't have to replace their guide animal every eight years or so. If they have a dog, they have a horse that can live longer. There's some other. It's a really interesting website, and so there's some information there if you're interested in learning more about service animals. So let's talk about the laws, and trying to look at the chat box here. I see that Shannon asked a question, and Shannon, we're gonna talk more about that when we get to the advocacy practice section. So if we don't cover it in the third section, make sure you let us know and ask us again. Okay. So let's talk about the laws that apply to domestic violence shelters and service animals. And so we get to include this great disclaimer. We're going to be talking about the laws here, and this information has been reviewed, but whenever you have a specific situation in your shelter or in your program that relates to legal issues, that relates to service animals and shelters and the law, you really need to get individual legal help. We're not offering you specific legal advice. This webinar is done for non-lawyers and is general information. Okay, so there are four laws that apply to domestic violence shelters and service animals. Three of them are federal laws and one is a state law. The federal laws are Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, the Fair Housing Amendments Act, and then the state law is the Washington's Law Against Discrimination. There are four different laws because when the laws were written, they wanted they were written to apply to different kinds of service providers or businesses or other kinds of entities. So there's four different laws to get at each of those different kinds of organizations. But domestic violence shelters fall under all four of these laws, so we're going to talk about all four of them. Let's talk about the state law first. The Washington Law Against Discrimination is a law that's actually broader than all of the three federal laws that we're going to be talking about. The Washington Law Against Discrimination applies to all domestic violence programs and shelters, and it specifically prohibits discrimination against people who use service animals and people with disabilities. One of the things that makes this law a little bit broader than the federal laws is that it says that any policy or practice that you might have that discourages a person with a service animal from using your services violates the law. Not just saying you can't come here because you have a service animal, that would be illegal under all four laws, but by discouraging a person who has a service animal, that is in violation of the Washington Law Against Discrimination. Under the federal laws, Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's a federal law, and Title III is essentially a chapter of the law, and it relates to all businesses and nonprofit service providers, and the ADA calls these places places of public accommodation. So any program that's operated by a domestic violence or sexual assault agency is a place of public accommodation, and so falls under the ADA, Title III, Chapter 3. So your program under the ADA is required to modify policies and practices so that a person with a disability can access your services. Generally speaking, your program is responsible for the costs associated with reasonable accommodations. But we're going to talk more in a little bit about what does that really mean? What's reasonable? What am I responsible for? What am I not? So we're going to talk about that a little bit more. Let's move on to the next federal law, which is Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. This is a federal law, and this covers any program that receives federal financial assistance. So all state-funded shelters fall under this. If you get VOCA funds, if you get FIPSA funds, VAWA money, RPE, STOP funds, even though that money comes to you through the state, those are federal dollars. So that means that you are subject to the provisions of Section 504 of the Rehab Act. This law is very similar to the ADA in many ways. It requires reasonable modifications to your policy and practice so that people with disabilities can use your services. That includes allowing people with service animals so that the person can participate in your program. The fourth law is the Fair Housing Amendments Act. So this one's a little bit different. This one applies to housing providers. A whole lot of housing providers are covered under this law, and shelter and transitional living programs for domestic violence survivors do fall under the Fair Housing Amendments Act. It also requires reasonable modifications and reasonable accommodations for people with disabilities, and service animals must be allowed this, under rulings by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which enforces the Fair Housing Act. If you're really interested in reading about laws, it might be a little confusing when you first compare the Fair Housing Act to the other two federal laws, the ADA and the Rehab Act. They use the term reasonable modifications and reasonable accommodations a little bit differently. When the Fair Housing Act talks about reasonable modifications, they're not talking about policy and practice. They're talking about building ramps, modifying your bathroom, so that a person with disability can use it, putting in door handles instead of knobs so that people can use them. Those are modifications under the Fair Housing Act. Reasonable accommodations gets more at policy and practice. So it really is saying basically the same things, but the language is a little bit different. Okay, I'm going to get back to this question that we sort of glossed over early on. How do I find out if an animal is really a service animal? Because there's a lot of folks who are really interested in this question. So there's an easy answer, and there's a complicated answer. And the easy answer, and this is what we really recommend that you go with, and it's going to take some thinking maybe to implement this, but this is the way we recommend you go. It's good advocacy practice to believe survivors when they tell you their animals are service animals. You don't need documentation. You don't need anything. You just need their word for it. This is good practice, and it also conforms with all four of the laws that we're talking about. Now, if you want to pursue the complicated answer has two different parts. So here's the first part. When a survivor comes to you for advocacy services, when they first contact you and they want to talk to an advocate, they want your services, you cannot ask for documentation of their service animal, and you cannot ask about their disability. The laws don't let you do that. If you feel like you must ask someone about the animal, you can ask. There's two questions that you can ask. You can ask, is this a service animal? And you can ask, what tasks does the animal perform for you? Other inquiries might leave you open to a discrimination complaint. Okay, so that's when they first come to you and want to use your services. When a survivor, however, comes to your shelter, then the Fair Housing Act applies, and it's a little bit different. A housing provider is allowed to ask for a statement from a healthcare provider, a healthcare or mental health professional, and the statement should say that the individual is a person with a disability and they will be assisted by a service animal. Now, note that this does not have to be a doctor. It does need to be someone who is able to understand what the person needs, but it does not have to be a medical doctor. Also note that that is all the statement has to say, that they have a disability and that they'll be assisted by a service animal. You may not ask for details about the service animal. You may not, except for what tasks the animal provides for you. You may not ask about the individual's disability. And it's important to note that your policy and practice should be consistent. If you ask one survivor for documentation about a service animal, you really should ask every survivor with a service animal. For example, someone is blind and comes to you, and they have a guide dog, and you say, yes, we've got a place for you, come on in. And then another person comes to you and says, I have an emotional support animal. And you say, well, you're going to have to get documentation for it. You really might be leaving yourself liable for some kind of a complaint at that point. Make sure that if you decide to ask for this kind of documentation, you should ask everyone. Your policy and your practice should be consistent. I see more questions coming in the chat line. That's great. We're going to try to get to those in the second part here. So. Thanks, Shonda, and a couple other folks I see have asked questions. That's good. So keep those questions coming. A lot of people want to know, so we're in a communal living situation. We've got a lot of people. We've got people preparing food. I need to keep the animals out of the kitchen. Well, you cannot. A person with a disability with a working service animal gets to go wherever any other survivor gets to go. So any place there are common areas, the person with the service animal gets to go there while the animal's working. You cannot keep them out of the kitchen. You cannot keep them out of common areas. So while that animal's working, it needs to be with the owner. Now the owner is responsible for maintaining direction and control of that animal. So that could be on a leash, or it could not. It could just be under voice command. The owner is responsible for having control of the animal, but while that animal's working, they get to go wherever any other survivor gets to go. So this is definitely a concern for folks. What if the animal's growling or threatening other residents or staff? And this can happen. If an animal is directly threatening somebody, ask the owner of that animal to get it under control immediately. So if there's a direct threat, get that animal under control immediately so that there's not an accident, there's not something bad happens. But I want to caution you, if you get a complaint from someone that an animal is being aggressive or is growling or is barking, take some time to find out what's really going on, because sometimes that animal's behavior can be misinterpreted. The animal may have had its tail stepped on. There may have been children teasing the animal and interfering with its work. I know of one person who had an animal. She had a social anxiety disorder, and the animal was a very well-trained animal and knew that when she was going to get panic attacks, it could sense when her anxiety was rising and when she was about to get a panic attack in social situations. And so what it would do would go up to her and sort of press against her legs, get between her and whoever she was talking with, and press against her legs, and it made sort of a sound. And sometimes people thought that animal was being threatening because it inserted itself between the two people, and then it made sort of a funny sound. But what that animal was doing what it was meant to do and helped calm the person down and kept her from having a panic attack. So if you get a report of what's going on, take the time to find out what is really going on before you act. That can really save you some heartaches. Come on, slide. There we go. Now, if you have an animal that's actually threatening staff or residents, obviously this is something you want to deal with, and you want to deal with it quickly. There are three reasons that you can ask a person to remove their service animal. One is if the animal is posing a direct threat to the safety of others. Two is if the animal is disruptive and interfering with programming or the provision of services. And three is if the animal is creating an unsanitary condition. So we're going to go through each of these individually. So if an animal is posing a direct threat to the safety of others, in order for you to take action for this reason, you've got to have actual evidence that there's danger. You've got to have an animal that's really growling at somebody, really threatening somebody. You can't ask an animal to be removed just because someone's afraid of it. And you can't, for instance, ban pit bulls because you think they're dangerous. There has to be actual danger, an actual threat presented. Then you should ask the person who owns the animal that say that the animal's posing a threat and the animal's going to have to go. The second reason you can ask to have an animal removed is if the animal is disruptive and interfering with programming or the provision of services. Normally, how this might present itself is if the dog is excitable, or the animal's excitable, barking, jumping up on people, pestering people because it's friendly, wanting to play. If this is the case, or if the animal is disruptive in any way, that's really keeping you from doing your work and keeping the shelter or the program from doing what you need to do, talk with the owner. You know, sit down, say, "This really, we got to deal with this because we're not able to do our work here." So ask if they can get the animal under control, and in almost all cases, you're going to be able to come up with a resolution to this kind of issue and get the animal straightened away. Remember that the animal is probably really stressed being in a communal living situation just like everybody else there. And talking with the survivor can really almost always take care of these situations. If it doesn't, if the behavior keeps on going, if things are falling apart, if you can't do what you need to do, then you can ask the survivor to remove the animal. The third reason for removing is if the animal is creating an unsanitary condition. Now, this gets a little bit tricky in some cases. I know that people in shelters are really worried about poop. This is, you don't want people stepping in it. You don't want kids stepping in it. You don't want it in the play areas. It's an issue. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the advocacy practice section. But if the animal is creating an unsanitary condition, you can ask that the animal be removed. But you should note a couple of things. One is that if the survivor has a disability, the disability may prevent her from cleaning up after the animal. And although the law may not require you to provide that kind of assistance cleaning up after that animal, it could be considered a reasonable accommodation. And I know that has happened in some places, and folks have found ways to make that work. There's one other thing to consider, and that is this. People who use service animals rely on them a whole lot. It's really important to their lives. And if they're in an abusive situation at home, it makes that animal a prime target for the abuser. If the abuser can control that animal, takes care of the animal all the time, feeds the animal all the time, exercises the animal all the time, cleans the animal all the time, controls when that animal goes to the vet, controls everything about that animal, that allows him to exert greater control over the victim survivor. This is really, really, really common, that an abuser will target a service animal in ways like this. So it's really possible when that survivor comes to you with her service animal, she may not have taken care of that animal ever and may not know what it takes, may not know what to do. So giving her some support in that area and helping her figure out what it takes to take care of the animal herself is going to build her independence and her self-determination and really give her some skills that she's going to need as she moves on with her life and expand the array of options she has as she moves forward. So I really encourage you to give people some support around that in situations like that. Okay, someone's asking, Marianne's asking about allergies. We're going to talk a lot about allergies when we come up. And Faye wants to know if we can get copies of the PowerPoint slides. I'll be happy to send slides to anybody as we go, when we're done. So you can email me at the end of this today, and I will send you the PowerPoint slides. And at the end of today, both Summer and I will give you our email addresses. So I want to get back to removing the service animal for the three reasons, and there's one more thing that you really need to understand. And that is that if the situation gets bad and you do need to ask a survivor to remove her service animal, you should make it clear that she or he is welcome to continue participating in the shelter. And you must say, are there ways that we can make that happen? Are there reasonable accommodations that we can offer you so that you can continue to participate here? So if you have to ask a person to remove their animal, make sure you offer to them the opportunity to stay and accommodation so they can. So we've been talking a lot about what your responsibilities are when someone comes to you with a service animal. Let's talk for a couple minutes about what what the survivors and the service animals' owners' responsibilities are. They have to maintain control of the animal at all times. While it's in common areas, it needs to be under their direct control. And as I said before, that can be on a leash, or it can be under voice command. When in the presence of others, that animal is expected to be well-behaved. The owner needs to take care of the animal. That means food, water, exercise, and cleaning up. This comes up fairly regularly. What if the animal doesn't have the shots that it needs, or an animal license? Animal licenses and requirements for shots vary county by county. So you might want to talk to your county officials and find out what the rules are in your county for licensing and for and for shots. There's a little water there. Service animals do need to comply with these laws. It's very likely that the survivor is going to show up at your shelter without the documentation that she needs to prove these things. She's going to need that as she moves on with her life. So you all are really familiar with helping people get the documentation they need. This should not be an issue, a big issue. Obviously, it's going to take some work, but helping her get that documentation would be really helpful to her. Now, it's possible that she'll show up and the animal does not have a license and does not have its shots. Your agency might want to assist her in obtaining those things. And one of the things that advocates around the state have done, and they've had just great success with, is making alliances with their local animal rights activists, with their local humane society, with their local animal rescue folks, with WAIF, with all sorts of animal rescue folks who would be thrilled to volunteer their time to help out with you to do your work. And there's something that they can do. They can help you get those vaccinations, get the license that you need, help you out on all sorts of things. And we're going to talk about this more as we go. There's some really great benefits for building those kinds of relationships with animal rights activists and humane societies and shelters in your area. Okay, I promised that we would talk about reasonable accommodation and cost. So here we go. We're going to talk about it a little bit right here. So if someone comes to you and needs a reasonable accommodation, and it's going to cost you some money, sit down and in a very welcoming way, letting people know that they're welcome there. Talk about what solutions to this access problem can we do. What can we do that will work for you here? And you'll be amazed at the low-cost or, in many cases, no-cost solutions that folks with disabilities can come up with, because they do this all the time. They face barriers everywhere they go, day after day after day, and they're used to getting around them. And they're used to coming up with low-cost and no-cost ways that they can get access to what they need. So having this conversation is really a good way to start about dealing with those kinds of access issues. Now, generally speaking, if an accommodation is going to cost you some money, it's going to be your responsibility, generally speaking, if it's reasonable, if it's readily achievable, and if it doesn't require you to make changes that would fundamentally alter the nature of the services you provide. The law does not say that, does not require you to provide an accommodation that would result in an undue burden on your program. Now, that whole paragraph there is laden with legal terms. So let's identify those really quickly. Reasonable, readily achievable, changes that would fundamentally alter the nature of the services you provide, and undue burden. If you go to the website ada.gov, you can find on that very large website discussions about what those terms really mean. In general, they have their common sense meaning. But if you're interested in learning more, you can go to the examples in the case law and find out what those terms mean in your case. It's on an individual basis. Someone who goes to the Microsoft Corporation and asks for a reasonable accommodation that costs $1,000, that might be totally reasonable for Microsoft's budget, and it might be totally unreasonable for your budget, depending on what the budget is and what the accommodation is and what the access need is. So it's individualized, which is really the beauty of the disability rights laws, that they individualize what the person with the disability needs to get equal access. Okay. We are going to move on into advocacy practices that provide access to your services for survivors with disabilities. This is the meat and potatoes. And I'm going to talk about this first one, and then I'm going to turn it over to Summer, and Summer's going to have a good time. And then I'm going to go back, and while Summer's talking, I'm going to try to compile all the questions here that I see there are some more that have come in. So I'm going to try to compile the questions and make sure that we cover those during this last section. As you try to develop a policy or a protocol around service animals, you might want to think about your screening and intake practices. And I want to explain a little bit why I say this. For years and years and years and years and years, folks with disabilities have experienced discrimination. They go to a service provider, they go anywhere. I'm not just talking about domestic violence programs, sexual assault programs, I'm talking about in life, everywhere they go. They run into barriers because people think these people are going to be hard to serve. I'm going to have to do extra things. They're hard to understand. They're scary, maybe. All the things that happened that people are afraid of about people with disabilities or are worried about what people with disabilities come into play. And what has happened is that they've developed screening tools that screen people out of services, that keep people from coming there. People with disabilities face this every day, 100 times a day. When they come to you, they are really going to need your services. And they are going to totally be expecting to get the same thing from you. They are totally going to be expecting that you're going to screen them out of services. And when you start asking the questions that you ask to do your screening and intake, which is you need to do that, it's going to be really easy for these survivors to perceive that you are going to screen them out of services, even if that is the farthest thing from your intention. So that's something that you can do some thinking about. And on this slide, you can see at the bottom the link to our screening practices for domestic violence victims with disabilities that can sort of help you think through your screening and intake policies and procedures and help you sort of go through them with an eye towards what questions that we currently ask might be perceived as screening somebody out. So I really encourage you to take a look at this model protocol as well and think about your screening and intake policies and practices. Summer, you want to take over?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hello, everybody. This is Summer Carrick, and I am here to talk about some of the issues in problem solving to ensure that we can have successful placements of DV survivors and their service animals. And I do have to say that when I first started thinking about this topic several years ago as a shelter manager, I really did feel like I was going to have a heart attack when I was thinking about working with service animals in shelters. So I'm coming very humbly, and I also have gone around the state and talked to programs who have made it work. So, and I have had experience making it work myself. And so the purpose of this section is to really talk about how shelter workers have worked it out, which, you know, one program in Washington State has a motto or mantra that is shelter workers work it out, and how they have really planned well and made the alliances needed to make this work. So here is a list that Phil has put together of issues and problem solved, being sanitation, which Phil has touched on, and we will go into advocacy practices, liability, allergies and fear of animals, licensing and shots, how to talk with the survivor, how to talk with your other participants in the shelter setting, what happens with disruption of programming, dangerous animals, and asking for documentation of service animals. So we talked about some of these in the context of legality. Let's talk about it now in the practical sort of context, which is how do I, shelter worker, work with these issues? How do I plan around them? And how do I set up great systems so that when these things come up, I know what to do? In my own personal experience and in the experience of many shelter workers that I've talked to around the state, there has been just a lot of anxiety around this topic, mostly because there's a lot of folks have been really sort of unclear about what our roles and responsibilities are as providers and what the survivor's responsibility is. And so when that's not clear, it can be very stressful. And so the legal portion has really, really clarified that for us, and it's also really clarified what we can and cannot do when it's not working, right? So we can, like, sort of, like, let that go. That being said, you know, we're advocates. Our job is to eliminate barriers. Our job is to help make it work for people. And so let's kind of talk about how we can do that. So sanitation is a big topic, caring for the animal. So we know that the survivor is responsible for the care of the animal. But as advocates, we know that we want survivors to be safe, and we know that we have this life-saving service, which is sheltering women and children. And so she may need support with that responsibility. So Phil talked a lot about how the abusers often use the animal as a means of control. Also, we know that having an animal is a challenge in itself, right? I'm sure that many of you have tried to find survivors' rentals with an animal, may have tried to find rentals themselves. I know that I have had a really, really hard time over the last 12 years, you know, renting with a dog. So it's an additional barrier to her getting safe. And so as advocates, we're always trying to find out how to mitigate that. So as far as sanitation goes, what programs have shared with us in Washington and California is that the best way to address sanitation issues is to plan really well by finding allies. So a lot of programs have said, you know, I was surprised when we went to the table together to talk about really preparing for survivors with disabilities and service animals, that some of the staff didn't find it as offensive to help with sanitation work. And other staff really, really didn't want to do that. And so we sort of sat down and worked out who was comfortable with what and when and in what circumstances. Other programs have said, you know, our advocates don't want to deal with that. They've got all these things to do. And they have gone ahead and established local animal rights activists, local shelter folks, animal shelter folks, humane societies, rescue societies, concerned people in the community to establish kind of partnerships or sort of like MOUs, formal or informal, so that they can be called in when help is needed. And so programs have really, really been excited to share that that has worked out really, really well. And what that means sometimes is having a plan A and a plan B and having it written into protocol and having everybody really aware of how that will work. But it's been very, very successful for all of the programs that have reported that that has been their strategy. Phil talked about animals in food preparation areas and how the animal does need to be in all areas where the survivor needs help with those tasks. Programs have shared that that has been, you know, not a big challenge, that, you know, ordinarily the animals work the task and move along. We joke a lot about poop because that is the big thing we have had programs tell us about, how animals can be particularly stressed, and when they're stressed, they can have serious poop issues. And so another way that programs have shared with us that they have sort of worked around that is by having those alliances built up again, either internally with your staff or externally with volunteers, and having them do a regular schedule so that the animal gets out when they need to, or a regular schedule for cleanup if the animal's having a hard time. Also having alliances with local veterinarians if the animal becomes ill. And that is one of the reasons why the sanitation becomes an issue. A lot of programs have asked questions about confidentiality of the shelter location, confidentiality of other participants. What programs have said to me is, well, you know, this isn't really an option. We need to accommodate survivors with disabilities. We need support around that. So some programs have had these animal health volunteers come through their volunteer process, and they are actually integrated as volunteers for the program that are donating in-kind services, even if it's on an as-needed basis. And other programs have done just sort of like service contracts. Like if you have people come in and fix your sink or what have you, some programs choose to not disclose what kind of facility they are. Some programs do choose to disclose that and have people sign confidentiality agreements about the location or about who is there. So whatever your protocol, you can adapt it to work with people. I mean, the truth is we have people helping us out and supporting us in shelter. So that hasn't been a big issue for programs. The other topic that comes up a lot is fleas. And if you work in shelters, you know that we do have all kinds of funny pests. We've had, you know, fleas, lice, scabies, you name it, we end up with it. And the truth is that whether or not you have an actual animal in shelter, we end up with fleas anyway an awful lot of the time because people bring them in with their suitcases. And, you know, I remember in California cockroaches were a big problem, and I'd watch them run out of someone's suitcase as they were doing their intake. So, you know, our pest control, you know, issues are our pest control issues, and we will problem solve them and we will work with them. But programs have reported that they're not having more flea problems than they did before they were working with folks who are accompanied by service animals. So something to think about. Next slide. I know that as a shelter manager, I was very, very worried about liability. You know, we're thinking about protecting the organization. We're thinking about protecting our programs so that everybody has an opportunity to access them. And I think liability concerns have really led to the no animal policies. But it's really important to be able to articulate to your staff and other participants and within your organizations and communities that denying or discouraging a person with a disability from using your service also exposes you to liability. So if you have a lot of concerns about that, you can check with your legal person, with your attorney for your organization about those issues. The programs that we've talked to have really focused on the fact that denying or discouraging a person does expose you to liability. So I'm moving along. Allergies, fear of animals, aversion to animals. This is a really stressful point because a big part of our work in shelters is maintaining house harmony with a lot of different people, with a lot of competing and conflicting interests, and it's very stressful, especially with the caseloads that we have, with the work pace, with the nature of our work, with the amount of crisis. It's very challenging. So in addition to that, like there are, and I want to acknowledge that there are cultural considerations. You know, I've certainly had situations where someone comes from a religious or cultural background that is very clear about animals being indoors, that it's not something that you do, and you know that's a competing interest with someone who needs an animal for their health and safety and well-being. So one of the things that programs have talked about that has been really helpful is sort of not being like super freaked out about that and taking some time to, number one, plan it in advance, number two, talk to people about what living with a service animal means, and And number three, not assuming that the survivor is responsible for resolving the situation. So this isn't as scary as it looks. What programs have said is that if there is concern in the house about a service animal being present, that often we can go to the survivor themselves and sort of talk to them about, okay, so there's fear and concern, and what do you think about that? And I think, Phil, are you still there?
I'm here.
Do you want to add some of your ideas around the tension of the confidentiality around the survivor's disability and wanting that person to have ultimate to have total control about what information is disclosed when, and also how helpful it is to educate everybody in the house about working with service or about living with service animals?
Yeah.
Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the questions that one of you wrote in about. So, yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. We already mentioned how the confidentiality around disability is a little bit different than the confidentiality around the domestic violence situation. Folks with disabilities may want to keep a lot of their disability-related information confidential, too. Or they may not. But you're not going to know until you start having a conversation with that person. And I think there's some ways you can start off that conversation. You can ask them, what task does your animal perform for you? Again, I would welcome them to the first. We're really glad you're here. Assure them that that they're welcome, that they're going to get the services that they're going to need, and say, so we got a communal living situation here, and I want to make sure this goes well for you. What tasks does the animal perform for you? And that can start a conversation that will help you get to what can I talk to other residents about? Because other residents are going to want to know, what is this animal doing here? Someone asked a question, so what if someone has wanted to bring their dog and you said no because it was a pet, and now someone else shows up with a service dog? So you need to have the permission of the owner, of the person with the disability, to disclose any of this stuff about disability. So having this conversation can get at what she's comfortable sharing, how she'd like to have the information presented, and what she would like to not have shared. But having that conversation around what's it going to be like living here in shelter, I think can really form an alliance between you and the survivor, rather than set up an adversarial situation where she's not going to trust you. Instead, enlist her in your side. Say, what should we tell everybody? What people are going to want to know about the animal. People want to know what they can and can't do to the animal, when they can and can't play with the animal. They want to know why the animal's here. Having that conversation and getting the permission and enlisting her as an ally can really help you get there. Summer?
Yeah. And Phil, did you want to talk any more about the allergies and some of your experiences?
Yeah, let's just talk really quickly about allergies. I just want to make sure that people know what the laws say about allergies. Someone has a service animal, it means they have a disability, and it means they're protected by disability rights laws. Someone who has an allergy, I have allergies, and let me tell you, the last couple months have been pretty miserable. Allergies are really a pain, I really get it. But most of the time, they don't rise to the level of something that really prevents me from doing what I need to do during the day. So the person with the service animal, a person with a disability, is protected by the laws, and the person with the allergies generally is not. So the law says that someone else having an allergy is not a reason to exclude the animal. Now, you can usually sit down with folks and say, can we arrange schedules so that the allergic person doesn't come into contact with the animal very much? Can we do that? Are there other ways that we can make this work? In rare cases, a person has severe allergic reactions. Obviously, that's a different case. And in that case, you've got someone who has a disability, someone who has their allergies actually create a disability for them. And then you've got creating accommodation needs, and you're going to have to sit down and figure out what you're going to do. It might be that someone has to go. to a hotel or somewhere else. You shouldn't assume that one person or another person has to go because there's a conflict. You should sit down and try to figure out how we're going to make this work. I think that's it for on allergies.
Thanks, Phil. I really appreciate that. And what programs have told us is that, you know, like, usually going through those channels always eliminates the problem. So that's helpful and comforting. I'm sure there are always exceptions, but okay. So the other question is licensing and required shots. Programs have shared that when they know their county's requirements and they follow the same protocols that they do when they're helping a survivor get other documentation, it works out really great. They work out partnerships with folks who want to donate money for the licensing fees. They have a whole protocol down on how to get that information, and it really, really helps the survivor in the long run as they're working to get more permanent housing, et cetera. So Phil talked a little bit about how to talk to the survivor about how the animal will fit in, and he did say that you know, the first and foremost, really assuring the survivor that she and the animal are welcome is super important because chances are she's experienced many, many, many circumstances where she and the animal were not welcome. So that's like your very first hurdle in establishing a really great advocacy relationship. Sorry, so slow, guys. I don't know what that's about. So I don't know why it's not turning over, but hopefully it will while I'm talking. The next one is talking to staff and other survivors about the animal. And so one thing that is really helpful to prepare ourselves for a successful placement and successful placements is all of the staff really, really understanding what a service animal is, what they do, and how to interact with service animals. And there's a link on a previous slide to the Delta Society, and they have a little handout that one of the programs in Washington State has modified for their use that's all about etiquette with service animals. And it's part of their staff orientation, it's part of their participant orientation. That information is available to help people understand how to interact with a service animal and all of the basics. You can find it on the Delta Society's website, which was listed before, where you can Google search the Delta Society and find a lot of supportive materials there. You're also free to email Phil or I, and we will send that out to you. It's not perfect, but it's a great start on that particular form. And then the other thing that's super helpful that Phil talks a lot about is getting permission from the owner of the animal and considering the confidentiality. So it's just like any other time you talk about confidentiality and information with survivors. You talk about the benefits of disclosing information and the possible cons of disclosing information. And what programs have told us is that survivors with service animals the vast majority of the time are really glad to help people in the house understand the service animal and all of the tasks that it performs so that everybody can get along really well. So again, I don't know why it's happening so slowly. I'm going to continue. But the other bullet point is disruption of programming. So some folks have asked us questions, and it's pretty clear in the law what we need to do if there's a disruption of programming. Obviously, we want to try to make it work first and foremost, and we just—I think that a lot of advocates get worried that they can't address anything because they're afraid that they're going to be discriminating, and that's certainly not what the law says. You can ask the survivor to control the animal, and if the problem's not resolved, you can ask her to remove the animal. So somebody had asked the question earlier, what if the animal is biting, et cetera. I mean, that's a threat, and we do have to sort of acknowledge that. So, you know, that's actually, that would fall under disruption of programming. It's just super important that we invite her to stay and offer accommodation so that she can without the animal. I know that our first thought is to just, you know, tell the participant that it's not working out, but really we have to stay clear on the behavior of the animal and offer the service to the survivor. So Phil talked a little bit about how the behavior can be misinterpreted. My experience with service animals in shelters that's been echoed around the state is that they're often stressed for the first couple days. We can sort of plan around that, too. Oftentimes, when we're working with a survivor, we talk about when they first come in sort of how this can be a stressful situation and that there is a period of acclimation. And we often check in with them, like, how are the kids doing? How are they adjusting? How can I help support that adjustment process? We can do the same thing for a survivor who is accompanied by a service animal. I mean, we can sort of upfront say often service animals can be stressed. There's a lot of new people here. There's been a change in environment. Your stress level has gone up. Animals sense that. How can we help make this as easy as possible? And that can be in the form of walking around the physical space, helping the survivor identify areas of the house that might be quiet areas, helping the survivor identify strategies for what she can do when things are getting tense in the house or crowded or loud or whatever. So we can really help plan so that the animals are less stressed and there's less potential for dangerous reactions. So the next slide is just going back on the prior conversation about asking survivors for documentation of their animals. The real key is that the program really decides, are you going to require documentation or not? If you're going to require documentation, I really hope that you obtain legal advice before you proceed, because it's very, very important that your policy is consistent, that your staff is well-trained, and that time you request documentation, it's consistent, and you are asking everybody for documentation. Of course, it's recommended, Phil and I have sort of thought a lot about this, it's recommended that you don't ask for the documentation because that adds an awful lot to your screening and intake process. It sets you up for sort of an adverse advocacy relationship rather than a helping advocacy relationship, and also there's just so much room to make errors there, and there's so much room to make a survivor not feel welcome. So it's definitely your choice, but make sure you get that legal advice if you're going to require documentation so that you're in full compliance. Things to remember. Again, repeating, make sure that the survivor feels at ease. Let her know that they're welcome. Talk to the survivor about an animal. There's no reason that you can't have conversations about it, about communal living and what you can share with other staff and residents, and that she's fully informed about what the possibilities are for sharing information and how it can make the living experience better, but also that she is entirely entitled to not sharing anything. Consider the confidentiality, which we talked about, and this is moving really slow. I hope it's coming up.
Summer, this is Phil. Just let me know. It seems to be working fine on mine.
So. Oh, it is. Okay, so it's not coming up for me. That's
yeah,
nice.
I think that's it.
I'm trying to do it based on memory here. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so we talked again about what to do when conflicts arise and how to build these relationships. Folks all over the state have amazing relationships with some of these local animal shelters and the Humane Society. I mean, it is a perfect way to engage your community because many, many folks want to contribute to eliminating domestic violence. Many folks feel very connected to our mission statement. And, you know, doing direct service advocacy is not for everyone. So this is one way that people can really help support domestic violence survivors. They can help folks with disabilities. And it's just a really, really great partnership. It's been very successful around the state and in California. Other things to remember is to really do the planning piece, planning. So you might want to establish a model protocol so that when someone's answering the phone at 8 o'clock at night and gets an application for your shelter services, that they can kind of go to that protocol and sort of go down the list of, you know, how they can set up a great program for that person. And then that addresses a lot of these issues. Because as we know in shelters, we often have, you know, staff coming and going, and, you know, it's not the sort of thing that happens every day for everyone. So it's good to have the planning done in advance and also have a reference place. And Phil has put together a model protocol, which is available on our website, that you can use to sort of go through and pick and choose what you want to have built into your protocol that is already researched and has already been commented on and designed with input from domestic violence programs all over the state. So hopefully that will help you, and you don't have to completely reinvent the wheel. Some programs have just adopted it altogether, but that will help you with your planning. And so this is sort of, you know, what we already talked about. Just if you do have to ask the survivor to remove her animal, make sure to invite her to stay. That's very, very important. So as I've been talking, I haven't been looking at all of these questions. Have you been keeping up with it, Phil?
I have. I've got a whole bunch of questions here.
All right. So why don't we take it from there?
Okay. There's a couple that I wanted to get Zach Burr's input on from Disability Rights Washington. So let's start off with Susan Hannibal's question. Susan has a really interesting question about safe homes. And Susan, could you unmute your phone by hitting *7 and ask your question, and then I'll take a crack at it. We'll probably ask you, Zach, to weigh in too.
Sure.
Hi, this is Susan Hannibal. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. My question really is around a few programs that the state funds for shelter services, but those shelter services are safe home programs, and so these are the homes, as the providers know, homes of individuals in the community who open their homes for several days, typically for survivors to stay in. And so I'm just kind of curious, for those programs that are safe homes, how do these laws apply to them? And what might change around the information we've received today in relation to safe home programs?
Do you have any thoughts, Summer?
No, I don't at all. That is, like, the best question ever.
Yeah.
I have no idea. So, it sounds like a legal question to me, but it depends on whether or not those safe homes fall under the criteria of, a place of public accommodation and a housing provider. Would that, I don't know. I think that that's something we might need to explore.
Right.
You think, Zach?
Yeah, I agree. I think that...
Can you bump up your volume a little bit more, Zach?
Sure. How's that? Is that any better?
It's a little better. Still really soft.
Okay. One second here.
Hello?
Oh, that's much better.
Much better, okay. I think I would need to know a little bit more about the safe homes and how they're run before I could make a determination one way or the other on those. But I think, do these safe homes, do they receive federal funds as well? Are they receiving funding through any sort of federal program?
Do you all want me to answer that?
Yeah, go ahead, Susan.
Okay. I think in all situations, these are volunteers in the community who are volunteers of the local domestic violence program, and their form of volunteering is to make their home available for a survivor and their children, if they have children, for, you know, between 3 to 5 days. It varies. And these are programs who I think in all cases do not have their own physical communal living type of shelter. This is their form of shelter, and they're in smaller communities. And so these are volunteers who have space in their homes that they've opened up.
Okay.
They're not receiving any funding, the homes themselves. They're volunteers.
Okay. Okay. And, one thing that would make me think that you might be able to get at maybe the fair housing requirements. Let's see. I think that you would maybe be looking at a place of public accommodation. So it may be something that would come under the Fair Housing Act potentially, and the requirements therein. It's definitely one of those gray areas, though. It depends, I think, you know, one thing that you might look at is how often are these, I mean, it may be something that you would need to know, frequency of how often this is done. Is it a common thing? Is it something where there's a history of this occurring, or is it a one-time event? There's some questions there that may affect how that's interpreted. So it's hard to say just straight away whether or not those would fall under the 504, or I mean 504 it would not, because there's no federal funding, but under some of the other requirements there.
Yeah, we'll do some more research on that. We'll see if we can find out the answer to that question. That's a tough one, Susan.
Yeah, certainly. I think it's a great question, and I'd like to look into that as well. Maybe Phil, we can maybe touch bases on that after the meeting, and we can come up with an answer for that one.
Let's do that. That would be great. I have one other question that I think you might want to weigh in on, Zach, and that's from Shonda. Shonda, are you there? And if so, can you unmute by hitting star seven, and then ask your question about transitional living and pet deposits? Oh, Shonda got called away, it sounds like. Her question is about transitional living when folks are going into an apartment. Oftentimes the domestic violence program will support that, to support them getting into an apartment. And yet they're privately owned apartment buildings who often require deposits for having pets present. And she asked if the person who has a service animal would have to pay that pet deposit.
Typically, no. No, if there's a service animal, the pet deposit does not apply because they're not considered pets.
Can I add to that, Phil?
Yeah.
So this is Summer, everybody. The other thing that's really interesting about that question is it leads us to another question, which is sort of further down in the chat box, which is, does this apply to other housing providers? And what's really exciting about this information is that many advocates have then taken it and used it to help advocate for folks with service animals to get into more permanent housing, because it does apply on many levels. And if you go back and review the laws, you can sort of figure out what works for what. But the fair housing laws, et cetera, do work to help advocates place people and get around a lot of the pet restrictions, because they are not pets, they're service animals. So advocates have happily reported that they've found it much easier to find permanent placement now that they know how to talk to landlords and others about folks with disabilities who have service animals' rights.
Let's move on to another question. Shannon, actually a couple people have asked questions about the number of service animals. One person asked about the number of animals that service animals you can have at a shelter at any one time. And someone else asked a question about how many service animals can an individual person have? My understanding is that the law doesn't cover that at all. It doesn't address that issue at all. But Zach, do you have anything to say about that?
No, I haven't seen anything about a requirement numbers-wise. I think that, I mean, the first part of that question, how many can a shelter have, as many as the residents therein would require for accommodations. And as far as the second part of the question, you know, how many can an individual person have? Certainly, if there were individual pieces of individual parts of the person's disability that could only be addressed by one particular animal or another, you know, certainly they could have theoretically more than one animal. But I have not seen any case law around that or any discussion of that particular issue. No.
Thanks, Zach. One of the things that makes me think about is that I know we had a long conversation with folks at another shelter on similar issues. They've They often get people with either multiple requests of people with a service animal or a request from a person with multiple service animals. And they find it to be difficult to navigate that. And I think one of the ways to address that it makes me think of, and Summer, I really appreciate hearing what you have to say about this, is to sort of take it away from where that seems to want to go. It seems to be a really adversarial situation. It says, someone says, you've got to take me and all my service animals, and the advocates say, you can't come here with all those service animals because we don't have room, and you've got this adversarial situation right off the bat. And I want to find a way to sort of back away from that and start over and say, okay, you need to be in the shelter, and you need our services, and we want to provide them for you. Let's sit back and figure out how this will work, and building a cooperative way to problem solve these issues rather than making it a tug of war right off the bat. What do you think, Summer?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've certainly worked in shelters where we had multiple service animals, and I sometimes think about creating a comic strip about it, because sometimes it was kind of funny. And the thing about shelter work, though, is that there's often situations like that, aside from service animals, where everything just sort of happens at once and things just feel a little bit bananas. And we get through it and we work through it and we talk to people and we talk to survivors about what they need. And it seems to me that the folks around the state who have sort of taken that approach have found that it's just been a delightful experience, if not a little bit extra challenge in coordinating things. So, I mean, I guess I agree with you on that. And the truth is shelters who are working with service animals on a really regular basis are not finding that happens very often. But they are finding that it happens. So it is interesting that there's no case law around it. I wouldn't have no way of knowing that. But shelters are making it work with multiple service animals. And one program that was at one of our trainings said that one survivor's service animal had just had puppies, and they decided for their own definition that letting the puppies come was a reasonable accommodation that they could handle. And so they actually had a delightful time with the puppies. But I'm not saying that's a legal decision, but it's kind of a cute story, and people have found ways to work it out.
Cynthia asked a question about confidentiality. And Cynthia, if you're there, would you unmute by hitting *7 and say a little bit more about your question about confidentiality with clients and the confidentiality of your shelter?
Hi, this is Cynthia. I think you kind of answered it already. It was back when we were talking about having people come in and offer to help with the service animals. The confidentiality of our shelter being let out there, but also the confidentiality of other clients who are in the shelter who do not have service animals. That's what I was talking about.
So I guess I'm confused about, tell me more about your concerns about other clients' confidentiality when the service animal is there.
Well, I said I think you guys already answered that. By having them do a contract or something like that. My concern was at first when you guys were talking about having other volunteers or somebody coming in and helping with the service animals, like the cleanup or things like that, because we do not have a staff shelter. So our thing would be we would have to, besides advocates going over and, visiting with our clients and doing the normal things that we do, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we're not staffed. So we would have to contract out and have somebody come over to help with the service animals. And we were just wondering about the other people's confidentiality who do not have the service animals.
Yeah, and we did talk about that a little bit, and I have a little additional kind of tip that one program shared with me. Just in general, people handle maintenance folks, support folks, volunteer folks coming into the shelter in different ways. One way that a program described that they handle it that I thought was really really kind of survivor-centered and really nice, was just to make sure that everybody had that lived in the house knew what times that person would be there, so they could choose to be there during that time or not. So if they really didn't want any outside folks to know that they were staying there, that they had a choice about just, like, not being around for that half hour or hour period. So there's ways that you can coordinate it so that, you know, everybody's really well informed. Other than that, my experience in following up with that program was that most of the participants, well, all of the participants didn't actually take them up on that offer and didn't seem to mind, because the person had a function of supporting the organization and had signed a confidentiality agreement. So that's just a little more extra information on how programs have problem solved around that.
Let me go back and pick up some of these questions that were earlier. Let's see. Early on, Marianne asked about if these laws applied to homeless shelters or other kinds of shelters, as well as domestic violence shelters. I didn't actually research that, but I'm pretty sure that they do. Zach, is that accurate?
Could you repeat that, Phil?
Yeah. Do the laws that apply to domestic violence shelters also cover homeless shelters and other kinds of shelters?
Yes, they are designed to be broad in application. You know, the Fair Housing Act and Washington Law Against Discrimination, and some of the other you know, the Americans with Disabilities Act. Those are going to apply equally to the, you know, to domestic violence shelters as well as homeless shelters. Typically, you know, they will overlap. Yes.
Great. Thanks. Dale asked a couple questions. He asked about, we talked about other residents who have allergies. He asked about other employees who have allergies. And what we said about residents having allergies applies to employees as well. So generally speaking, having allergies is not a reason to exclude someone with a service animal. Unless there's a really severe allergy, then you've got a conflict and you're going to have to problem solve around that.
Right, Phil. If I could just add that in there, you know, you can really look at making an accommodation for both parties at that point. There's sometimes there are ways to accommodate both of those individuals in a reasonable manner.
Right.
Also, I just wanted to comment that one program said that they had built into their new employee sort of orientation, you know, sort of like this, you know, when they describe all of the things that could happen in the job function, that was one of the things that could happen, so that they could sort of pre-plan, so that if, you know, so that it's not like you have a survivor there and then someone shows up for work and you have this problem, right, so that they could kind of pre-plan so that when it happens, everybody's accommodated. I just wanted to comment on that.
Dale asked another question that leads into another question that I believe it's Cheney asked. And Cheney, if I'm butchering your name, I apologize. But Dale asked about what if a survivor has one service animal and one pet. And Cheney went on to ask about if we know of any shelters that have changed no pets policy after having service animals come into their shelter. So specifically to answer Dale's question, obviously these laws apply to service animals. So if you have a no animals policy, the no animals policy is going to apply to the pet, but it's not going to apply to the service animal. But Cheney's question about shelters is a great one. And Shonda, have you come back by any chance, Shonda, from the Spokane Y, or the, not Spokane Y, from the Pierce County Y? And if you are there, hit *7 to unmute.
Hello?
Oh, there you are.
I'm here.
Would you like to talk about your experiences with animals?
I love animals, so my experience has been great.
Do you have a specific question?
Yeah, so Cheney asked if any shelters around the state had changed their no pets policy after having service animals in the shelter.
Kind of. I think probably originally we probably started off with only allowing service animals, and then since there's been no problem, now it's just animals, period, are allowed. And so And we've had, like, no more, it hasn't been like, oh, and, like, we've been inundated with people coming in with animals all of a sudden. It's about the same of having service animals in the shelter or if we have pets in the shelter.
I'll also comment, Phil, that several programs have made this transition over the last 2 years even. And it's been really interesting to watch because at one point I thought that it just was logistically not a possibility. And now I'm seeing that many programs are making it work, even if they don't have the most ideal space. So, if people have more interest in that, they can email me and I will send you contact people from shelter managers around the state who have told me they want to talk about these things if other programs want to kind of try to experiment and see if it's doable.
And this is Shonda. What I've noticed, too, whether or not it's a service animal or a pet, people who want to bring their pets with them into shelter or typically really responsible pet owners, regardless if it's a service animal or a pet, and typically, you know, they take really good care of their pet, they clean up after them, they're responsible, their pets are well-mannered, they're not going to bring their pet into a situation where they're going to become liable because their pet's going to bite someone or harm someone, something like that. So generally, it all goes really well.
Megan asked about what happens if a dog actually bites a resident. Summer, you want to talk about that?
Well, I mean, if a dog actually bites a resident, you definitely have a problem, and I've had that experience myself. So it has happened, although very occasionally. And so what we talked about is we want to prevent things like that from ever happening by planning well and talking to survivors about sort of how to make the pet the service animal as unstressed as possible. But if it does occur, then you have a situation where you need to talk to the survivor about whether or not that placement is going to work out for the long haul. And many programs have said that they have had to ask service animals to be removed. But it's important, again, as I said before, that you don't ask the participant to leave, but rather the animal to leave. Did I cover everything there, Phil?
Yeah, I think so. I really like the way you talk about planning and trying to keep situations from happening. The first time that you have a service animal come into your shelter, it's going to be stressful for you because it's unknown. It's something that's never happened for you before, and it's real easy to go to a place where you're worried and you're sort of pushing back. And I think really having that good conversation with the survivor at the beginning and building a partnership with her or him to figure out how this is going to work for the shelter, for the program, for the survivor, and for the animal builds an alliance and builds a win-win situation where you're going to avoid a lot of these problems and you're going to have an ally if a situation does develop where you can respond together. Let's see, what other questions are on here? Marianne asked a question about tenant rights in private housing. And I'm not quite sure what your question is specifically. Marianne, if you're there, could you hit *7 to unmute and ask your question? Oh, you got it? You already got it answered? Okay.
Yeah, I think they got it answered.
Great. Great. I think all the other questions that we came over on the chat, we've answered. Are there any other questions? Anything else that we can address that hasn't been addressed?
Phil, do you think you could go over what Angela's comments are about emotional support and companion animals? I know you did, but she's. Is there anything more to add about that? Because a lot of programs are talking about emotional support animals, companion animals, prescription animals, service animals. And I think that the point that she's trying to make is that they are all protected under the law.
Yeah.
Because it seems like folks get into this sort of space where they're hearing all these different titles and labels and not sure what fits under what, and it all fits. Is that correct, Phil?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of the confusion is because this is relatively new practice and
hey,
a relatively new thing. So there's all kinds of different names. There's emotional support animal. There's companion animal. There's prescription animal. They are all protected as service animals. One of the things you might think of, though, about emotional support animals is that very often these are the animals that are more exotic. I shouldn't say it that way. I should say that when you get more exotic animals, they're very often their emotional support animals.
Well, there are some distinctions that are made legally between strictly emotional support animals and psychological psychiatric service animals. There are some nuances there, and it's something that you really have to be careful of because a strictly emotional an animal that's strictly emotionally supportive is not actually considered is not considered a service animal outside of the housing context. So within fair housing and within housing, it is considered a service animal, but not outside of that context. So it's a tricky area. It's something to be obviously within within the shelter, the area of shelters, it would be considered that. But outside, it's important for people to keep in mind that an emotional support animal that's not individually trained to provide a service that is specific to that person's disability is not considered a service animal. If it's just there to be if it's not individually trained to do anything, but it's simply there to calm the person, to serve as kind of a therapeutic creature, then that is something that's legally distinct from a service animal.
Well, let me say how I tend to think about this, Zach, and then tell me if I'm on the right track here.
Sure.
So, although emotional support animals often have specific tasks, they don't actually go and pick up something, or they don't alert somebody about something. They're still doing work. They're still helping someone alleviate symptoms, reduce anxieties, whatever. So when you have your initial conversation with the survivor or the service animal, and you ask your question about what does the animal do for you, what are the tasks, or what does the animal do for you, You can sort of get at that this is an emotional support animal. And this actually can, as you continue to have the conversation, as you build the ally with the survivor, you can find out when the animal is working and is with them and when it's not. And so, if, for instance, if you do have an emotional support snake, it's very possible that the snake isn't going to have to accompany this person into the kitchen because it's not working then. It can be in a cage in the person's room, and that she can access that animal's therapeutic value when she needs it. So having that conversation about what does the animal do for you actually, and building an ally with her, allows you to open up that conversation and find out what needs to happen. What do you
certainly
think about that, Jack?
That's a great way to approach it. I certainly think that making sure that you understand when it's working and when it's not is a great way to look at that. I guess stress that within the Fair Housing Act, emotional support animals are within residential areas, they are considered equally, they're considered a service animal just as any other animal would be. it's outside of that context where it gets a little bit sticky. So, you know, as far as people working in this context with shelters, that should be something that they can, you know, that they should welcome. You know, is the therapeutic animal. So certainly.
Great, thanks. Susan Clark. Hi, Susan. Has a couple questions. And Susan, if you're there, can you star 7 to unmute and ask questions?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. The first question I had was, when you were talking about different ways that shelters could incorporate service animals, I didn't hear any mention of Frank Ascione's program at Utah. I think it's University of Utah. And I didn't know if that was sort of outdated now or if it just, so far that model hasn't really worked.
I don't know what that is.
Okay.
Can you describe it?
My understanding, and maybe this is just specific to animals overall and not just to service animals, but Dr. Ascione, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, had devised an entire manual for domestic violence programs on how to incorporate animals into their shelters so that the owners didn't have to abandon them or choose not to enter shelter. And I think that, it had received some widespread coverage several years ago, and maybe that's not the case any longer. So I was just curious if anyone else had any experience with that and if it was still a reasonable model.
Well, I do know that there's some money out there for local programs to make their shelters pet friendly.
Uh-huh.
And I know that the folks out in Tri-Cities have gotten some of that money and have done that. And if there's anybody on the call who has gotten some of that money, I'd be happy to hear from you now. But I think that it's more at getting people with their pets into shelters to make sure that they do get into shelter rather than returning to an unsafe situation.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay, this is Summer. I'm going to just go ahead and put a link in the chat box to what you're referring to. I think he might have done a lot of work. The only thing I'm familiar with is the Safe Haven for Pets manual, which is very, very cool. Mm-hmm. And we have it also in our Whiskative library. So if you want to check it out, you can contact Sandy at whiskative.org, and she will mail it to your program, and you can mail it back when you're done.
Great.
Or you can check it out on this link. So I have not, you know, read it cover to cover, but it has been useful for programs planning for incorporating, you know, animals in their shelters in general. So I'm going to try to get into this chat box while we carry on.
Great, thanks.
And Susan, you had another question?
And that was just when Zach was citing to the Fair Housing Act, I guess how the Fair Housing Act was alone in including emotional support animals. I wondered if he had anything he could cite to that would assist me in finding that definition of emotional support animals being included in the Fair Housing Act, where other federal laws did not or made a distinction between service animals and emotional support animals.
You know, I think that comes through case law.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember if that's explicitly stated, but I think I think it is something that comes through case law. What I can do is I can look for that, and if there's a way to get information to you after the conference, I can certainly forward that on to you.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Sure, and Phil, do you have email addresses
I have Susan's email address. And,
okay.
If you haven't changed, Susan, I can get it to anybody here.
Okay.
Great.
Emily asked about service animals in public if they need to be identified by a tag or harness, and they don't. Service animals don't have to have any kind of identification when they're working, when they're not working at all. A lot of them do because the people who own them get very tired of people either questioning them about whether they have a service animal, if the animal is actually a service animal, or by just wanting to pet and play with the dog while it's working. So that's why you see so many harnesses, I think. That's my opinion about why you see so many harnesses, to keep other people from playing with the dog while it's working or with the animal. But they are not required to have any kind of harness or documentation or anything at all. I thought it was the Humane Society. Thanks, Shonda says that this money that's available for domestic violence shelters to assist them in getting having pets in their shelter, and that comes from the Humane Society. And I know that Susan Hannibal has distributed some of that information. Do you have any other information about that, Susan, that would be helpful for folks? Star 7 to unmute.
Nope, I don't have anything else.
Okay. And Summer has posted that information on pets and shelters. We're about 5 minutes away from our time. Are there any other questions? Anything else we can address? If you have a question, star 7 will unmute your phone. Looks like we're all done, though. Yes? Summer, do you have anything to wrap up with?
No, I just want to say thank you all for your hard work sheltering survivors. It is such a multitask sort of thing, and it's just, I mean, I just love it, and my heart's there, and I thank you so much for doing the work, and I know that this is challenging on top of everything else, but it's a beautiful thing to be in line with our values. So if anybody wants any help or support or wants to talk through things or has questions later, feel free to contact me at summer@wscadv.org.
And my email is phil, P-H-I-L, at wscadv.org, phil@wscadv.org, and we would love to hear from all of you.
You want to talk about certificates, Phil?
Yeah, I'll go ahead, Summer.
What we ask is that you send us an email at sandy@wscadv.org, and the reason why we ask you to do that is so that we know who all is on the call with you. So if you will just send an email with in the subject line service animals webinar with your name and your email address and the name of anybody else who was on the call, and we will get those certificates out to you.
And I have just put my email and Summer's email up on the screen, up on the chat box. So feel free to contact us. Thank you very much, everybody. This has been a really wonderful project for me to be involved with, and I know it has been for Summer, too. We've really enjoyed working on this, and we like talking about this subject, so we'd love to talk with you more if you have questions as things go on. If you want to get slides, go ahead and email us, and I see that I put out our email address, but I sent them to the wrong person. Okay, let me try this again. phil@wscadv.org. And summer@wscadv.org. There, I think everyone's seeing them now, yes? I hope so. So we'll leave this up for a minute or two so you can copy those down. We were happy to send the slides to you. Just give us an email, and we'll shoot them off to you. Anything else, same thing. Okay, Summer?
Yes, thank you very much, everybody.
Thanks, bye-bye.